You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the future of e-commerce. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Stefan.
So we're back. It's been almost a year.
Holy moly.
March 16th of last year is when we last recorded, and it was a podcast that people really enjoyed.
Jesse, shocking.
Jesse, for those uninitiated, Jesse is my co-founder and CEO at Lumi. She's really my boss, basically.
Oh, man.
But we've been collaborating, working on different businesses together for the past 8 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm. 8 years.
And our last episode together was episode 16. People seem to really like it, so we thought we'd do another round of mailbag questions from people. But first, I want to talk a little bit about some news that came out this past week. We raised a Series A for Lumi.
We announced our fundraise of $9 million for what we're up to and what we're building.
Yeah, I just thought it'd be fun to talk a little through some of the behind the scenes of how that went down. How do you feel like it went? First of all, I was really hoping that we'd get some like TechCrunch commenters giving us some...
Right, like, why are they building this company?
This is so stupid, like, or something.
Yeah, yeah. And we did. No one heckled us.
No one heckled us.
Yeah. We tried for heckling. No, we didn't try.
I was hoping we would have some controversy to talk
about. Right, right. Like something like... No, everyone was very, very supportive, which is really nice. But going back to the fundraise itself, like something that people might not know at home is that we just announced it. We announced on Valentine's Day. There's no special significance to that except that
it made it fun. Special somehow. I don't know if it was exactly intentional, but it seemed to work out perfectly.
Yeah. So we announced on Valentine's Day, February 14, 2018, but we actually were out pitching last summer and closed the round towards
September.
Fall. Yeah. Like kind of in fall of last year. And so we just chose not to announce during the busy Q4 season when e-commerce companies are running around with their heads cut off. We just kind of, we didn't have a rush around it, so we announced it now. But that's something people might not know is we were actually out there pitching and stuff last summer. And Stefan, what did people tell us when we started saying that we were going to go out pitching investors in like July and August?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. There's no good time to fundraise, but I think in the summer in particular, VCs, I guess, are known to go on vacation, or at least rumored to, but it didn't seem
rumored.
It didn't seem to be the case. I mean, the ones who, it's like a early bird gets the worm, you know?
You say there's no good time to fundraise. I say there's no bad time. I'm just joking. I think that essentially... Yeah, what you find is, sure, people take vacations in July and August. At the same time, a lot of people don't, and a lot of firms have a lot of partners, so there's always someone still doing business during that time. And ultimately, I think that's something that we both believe is that we focused on choosing timing that was good for Lumi. Because we wanted to be focused on the company during the busy season. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about it. It's like you should be choosing your timing based on what's good for the company, not whatever you've heard. You know, it's like about putting the first stuff first.
So I think for people who are listening, maybe, you know, we usually talk to entrepreneurs and folks who are building their own businesses, but some people might not be super familiar with Lumi and what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to give like a 20-second version of that? A 14-second version of that?
Okay, 14. So at Lumi, we help e-commerce brands source and manage all of their packaging, everything from custom printed boxes to stickers and pack slips, so that they can focus on making their product and selling their product and telling their story online. We can handle every other different physical thing that they need to order. And of course, we have an online interface that makes it really, really easy for them to do so. That's in a nutshell what we've been building. We have, of course, some powerful things that power that. One thing that we believe heavily in is understanding the geography of where all of these products are produced. So if you understand where every single corrugate box manufacturing facility is on planet Earth, it makes it a little bit easier to decide where to produce for a certain brand. So the data side is also really important to us. I don't know. Was that 14 seconds?
I think it was a little more. I mean, the thing that's funny is that, so, you know, right around this time last year, you hadn't even launched the YouTube show.
I know. My media empire. Is that what you meant to say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I run a media empire I call Shipping Things.
I feel like Wellmade is part of the empire.
I will allow it to be included in my empire, if that's your question.
It's not really a question.
I'm just kidding.
Well, so Shipping Things is a show about shipping things. It's a video show with you and some
I've birthed characters. A genre I refer to as slapstick supply chain. It's like Buster Keaton meets Diane Keaton meets Jeff Bezos.
I feel like there's got to be one more Keaton that you can roll into this.
I don't know. If his name was Jeff Keaton, for some reason, that would be an epic joke. But his name is Jeff Bezos, so whatever.
But, you know, it kind of delves into the more real side of what we do every day at Lumi, which is...
Well, what it really is it's for a very select audience. I'm not in it for the view count, folks. I'm in it to transmit real information to people who need it in an educational and fun format, all right? So what we're talking about is like something like, what is dimensional weight shipping? What is a custom poly mailer and what are your options? All of these things that are like really, really useful if you're running an e-commerce business or you need packaging, and not really useful if you don't, but you still might watch them because they're addictively hilarious.
I agree with this one. And also, just as someone who's been around Jesse for the past 8 years or more,
I need an outlet.
Almost,
you know,
10 years. I feel like it's a side of you. The slapstick comedy,
the physical comedy that
really doesn't have like very many outlets in your normal
day-to-day life. I'm a CEO, and apparently
you're supposed to be a serious business person.
You learn over time that physical comedy and CEO, the Venn diagram is
kind
of like two circles that don't.
Also, I feel like the height of slapstick comedy was like 1920.
I'm about 100
years behind.
I'm a lady out of an era. Right. I'm in the wrong era and also in the wrong job to have a real future in physical comedy. So I've got to carve my own path. And that's what you find me doing in Shipping Things. So I have a lot of fun with it, but I would argue it's very, very informative. We get emails from, you know, people with like serious operations titles at really large companies saying like, I'm using your videos to train my entire staff.
That feels nice.
Yeah, it feels cool. Great. It feels great.
I think we wanted to make it educational from the get-go.
Yeah, it's like a real, like, we're doing it really, truly does help Lumi customers. We're not just doing it for our health. Although, maybe it helps our health too. I mean, why not?
So let's zoom back to last summer when a Los Angeles-based company talking about cardboard boxes that's also involved in slapstick comedy goes up to Silicon Valley to raise pitch money.
Like a slapstick comedy.
sounds like a game. Sounds like a winning combination.
Right. Yeah, so I think that it was a very interesting time. I think raising money is stressful. Well, it's not that I think it. I think that this is an established fact. Raising money, it's a stressful process.
Why did we do this?
We are in a really massive industry and we have really big goals for how we can change and transform that industry. And the reality is we need to keep investing in the software side and keep investing in a lot of the bigger challenges on data and software that we're trying to solve. And that's the type of thing that requires capital. If we do our jobs right, the speed that we get by raising money truly has a net benefit in what we're able to do. So you raise it so that you can keep doubling down on that dream. And that's what we're doing.
So I think it's helpful to zoom back out. When we first started working together, basically the first 5 years, we worked on a completely separate business around a product called IncoDye that was I'm not going to go into the whole backstory, but it was a really interesting...
It's an art supply product that I'd been working on since high school. And then Stefan and I launched on Kickstarter, more of a bootstrapped company, you know, very, very different type of company. But it was a physical product that we had to put into a package. Stefan designed all the packaging. We figured it all out on our own. It gave us a lot of the knowledge that we needed to planted the seed of why physical supply chain and packaging is so hard for new companies and young companies.
And I was always trying to squeeze in software however I could. Like, it really made no sense.
He was really trying to squeeze it in.
Because we were making this art supply that was really just like a fabric dye, you know, like something that you would buy at an art store.
And he convinced me that we needed an app.
We made an amazing, really good iPhone app, and it had, you know, a back-end service that allowed you to get, you know, supplies and all this stuff. And I think that it taught us a lot about how to build software at a really small scale. I mean, we did it still completely bootstrapped off of our profits and from the Kickstarter campaign that we launched. And, you know, it was just one or two people, you know, building it.
I think that whole first company is a training wheels of sorts. Like, we experimented with business models. We experimented with product launches. We experimented with, you know, software in a completely non-software oriented company. And all of those things, all of those experiments, we're using the fruits of that knowledge. You know, now it's like, it's just awesome to be able to do all of that.
At some point, we'll have to do like the oral history of the whole thing and really like we'll write the book of that period of time. But at some point then, a couple years ago, 20...
What? We're going to do an oral history and then write a book?
When I don't know. One of those two. I just like write down
I'm
everything that happened.
I'm planning a comedy tour around it. So okay. To each their own.
All right. Well, in any case, all I was going to say is at some point we decided... Let's try this new thing. And you've actually recorded some really interesting interviews with other people, like the Making Ways one that you recorded recently. We'll put a link in the show notes. That was a great podcast that gives a little bit more history of that. But 2015, we launched the Lumi.com platform, and it was really a completely different direction and experiment in its own right. And I think it took us a good year and a half to 2 years to kind of figure out like what this really was.
Yeah. It took us all of 2015 to arrive on packaging and packaging-related and e-commerce-related items as the expression of the best way to help these brands grow. So the fact that it took us a year to kind of arrive on that, we went through the, you know, the idea maze on that subject. So yeah. So are we going to hop back to the fundraise?
Well, I was just giving people a little bit of
like
context.
Why?
Because you know, I think that for like... So Jesse and I, you know, you and I met studying industrial design. We met in 2008. We pretty much started working together like a year afterwards on the first basic ideas that became Incodi. And then that whole time was like a completely different category of business.
Right.
And I think for the longest time, you and I were trying to like survive. Like, we were like, this work
and
as
this,
a business?
You're bringing up a real good point there, Stefan. And it's that actually, so here's the really annoying thing about fundraise announcements. And this is also why it's not why we waited from last year, but it's part of the reason why we never announced our seed round and we just chose to focus on running the business. Because fundraise announcements, like, it is so, often they can feel so detached. Like, if you're out there and you're running a business that's bootstrapped or, you know, growing on its own capital, or you're just getting something started, or you have a creative project, I don't know, hearing that someone else raised $9 million is so like, it feels like it doesn't even, how did they even start to do that? It seems like so much money, and also like feels like so unrelatable. I guess that's what it is. It feels so unrelatable. I remember feeling like I'd read TechCrunch and read these places and just feel like I don't understand what's going on. And I guess what I'm getting at there is like, when you start to understand the progression of time that Stefan is describing, how we've been working on businesses together for 8 years, how it took us 4 years of running a first company to even gain enough insights to start this company. Then we run it for a whole nother year, a year and a half, where we're working on ideas that are sort of working and sort of not. Then things start working, and now we have a lot of positive momentum. And we are able to use that plus good ideas, plus an incredible team, plus software, like to then go do this fundraise process. It's just like so many and this and then that and then this and then that, that is usually what gets lost in the fundraise announcement is like, you know, that someone somewhere has been working on that thing for nearly a decade or forming those thoughts for that long. And I guess I hope I'm sharing this because I hope it's somewhat encouraging, just in the sense that, like, you know, it doesn't just happen randomly. And it is achievable. Like, it's so much more achievable with that kind of level of diligent work than it might seem when you're outside of that world.
Well, your bio I love on Twitter, which is, what is it?
I stuck with a simple idea for an unreasonable amount of time.
It's just... That is just the definition of what we've been doing basically this entire time, is just like sticking with it.
Sticking with it. Yeah. Like, just the concept that you are bound to have like this outsized level of knowledge in a field when you are the person that like just never quit it. And then, of course, you layer in your own intelligence and stuff on top of that and a good team and all the other stuff I just mentioned. But it's like, yeah, sometimes it is. It is as simple as that. Like, that is an overlooked, perseverance is an overlooked human attribute.
Not just perseverance, but sometimes just patience. Like, there's a problem that I always think about from back in our days as students in design school, which is like, you go to design school and you learn how to become a great problem solver. Like, people throw at you, like, how would you like improve this product? But you don't get good at finding good products or good ideas to work on.
Oof, and that can be really annoying. You can watch really smart people solving like inane problems.
This is why everyone who goes to design school or everyone who learns how to do a little bit of programming, like the first thing they'll do is something obvious, like a to-do app or something like that, because they're like, this is a problem I have all the time. But it's a problem that every person has had and has tried to solve a million times over. It's not an interesting problem. And we didn't find an interesting problem until we had like just struggled through like all these different
Didn't
problems.
Did we get a question around time?
Sure. I mean, we can jump into questions. We'll pepper in the questions.
Was that one about from the creative.
Oh, yeah. Here it is. Trevor Christensen asks, as a creative professional, I found that I generally have the energy for products that take about 6 weeks. Any longer and I tend to lose steam and find myself wanting to devote energy to my idea instead of finish what I've started. What are your recommendations for ways to keep the fire burning on long endeavors? Starting a company like Lumi are huge undertakings. How do you keep the momentum?
Wow, Trevor.
Trevor.
That is the tough question. And I think it just even the fact that you're asking it is really good, because something that I think about a lot when I see fundraise announcements and stuff is like, even if a company is doing great or a product idea is great, do the people running that company want to spend the next 5 or 10 years of their lives doing it? If the answer to that is no, it's almost a guaranteed flop as well. Like, so it is this tough thing of how do you find something where instead of 6 weeks on it, you might be willing to spend 3, 5, 7 years. There's no specific magical answer, but I would say that what you do is you, instead of thinking of it as a product, you think of it as a problem set that you find fascinating, and hopefully you got it right and that problem remains fascinating to you, because you can actually give yourself more runway for different solutions to that problem over time if you're still fascinated by the problem. So for Stefan and I, there's several problems inherent in Lumi that we find fascinating. We think that the problems that, you know, entrepreneurs run into when they're trying to grow companies, we like that problem group. We think it's interesting to help those people launch and grow companies. And we associate with those people. So we're selling packaging now. We will be for the foreseeable. But we but we're selling packaging because entrepreneurs need it. Like, it's like you have to, the solution stems from the problem, and we're fascinated by the problems that entrepreneurs run into. We're also fascinated by the problems of connecting the world of like intense manufacturing, which speaks one whole language of specs and sometimes literally different languages, to the groups of creative people who want to launch and run companies. So again, like, by finding an underlying problem and group of issues that fascinates you, I think what you'll find is that you have a lot of patience for trying all the different solutions. And that is so much more important than falling in love with a product idea or a certain expression. It's just an interesting way of thinking of it.
It's interesting that he mentions that he only has the energy for projects that mm-hmm. take about 6 weeks. It's very rare for me to have a project that takes more than 6 weeks. Because, you know, everything that we're doing whenever we're releasing a big new update or like a new set of products, I mean, 6 weeks is kind of like, 3 to 6 weeks is about like the length of an average project. Mm-hmm. It's just that we've strung along all these projects that generally have a similar theme.
And that is, so this is where I can give, Mr. Stefan over here a lot of credit, is like, a company is a bunch of projects and ideas enveloped into an organization and a brand, right? So if you think of a company like Amazon, you know the brand name, you might know Jeff Bezos, because...
Jeff Keaton, you mean?
Jeff Keaton, you might know Keaton. But I mean, when you start looking at what they're doing, they're doing so much stuff. Like, obviously there's Amazon.com, but there's AWS, there's all this other stuff. So I guess it's like, and if you broke down any one of those things into how they actually launched it, it would be a bunch of different projects and people and efforts. So it's like, it is about choosing and stacking up projects that lead to a greater whole that you could call a company, and then a group of people might rally around and call a brand. So that becomes, it's an interesting distinction just to realize that if you were to spend every day at Lumi, we are doing a bunch of projects that are smaller scale, and we're knitting them together into what we can call a company.
Yeah, find a bigger theme that you're really passionate about, and then just keep working towards that theme on different projects that assemble and knit together into a bigger thing.
Thanks, Trevor.
Another thing that I found frustrating, like back in the day when I would see these fundraising announcement, was just like, what is the news really? Like, mm-hmm. and it's the only thing that I can equate it to is, in the movie business, every movie that you go see in a theater is a $10 million minimum mm-hmm. project. Like, most of them that are the big budget ones are $100+ million things. Mm-hmm. And that money goes towards paying the actors, making the special effects, all this different stuff, the sets, the props. But unless you're really reading the trades, like mm-hmm. you don't see right. announcements of like, hey, these guys got $100 million to make a movie. Mm-hmm. You get the news when it's like a trailer just came out and right. it's like, whoa, this is going to be a cool movie. Or the reviews came out and this is a great movie. The news about the budget that they put together is not that interesting. No, and so that always, I found that frustrating.
Well, I think, so this is something else that I found frustrating before we were kind of part of what I sometimes refer to as like this ecosystem, which for anyone, I already have some weird words that I use as a CEO. But what I mean is like this kind of venture-backed investor ecosystem where companies are discussed in a certain way, fundraisers that are announced a certain way. And when you're running a company outside of that ecosystem, outside of that environment, you feel very much apart, and some things are very confusing about it. Something that I am now the beneficiary of, or that Lumi is now the beneficiary of, that I found confusing and sometimes annoying before, is like how investors will always be talking about their companies and praising their CEOs and stuff. And I guess that never annoyed me. That's not the thing that annoyed me. What annoyed me is sometimes I'd feel as like a CEO of a bootstrap company, like wow, I'm listening to all these podcasts, all this business stuff. I can read all these articles. And like, sometimes I'm hearing these people talk about someone who I feel like has maybe done less than me so far as a CEO. Or like, you know, I just went out in 6 months, got Lumi into 1500 retail stores, or Incodine into 1500 retail stores. And no one's talking about that on a podcast. Like, that was a really cool feat of sales and ingenuity.
When we were bootstrapping.
So what I'm getting at though, is that like, part of the difference in being outside that environment is it's like, I think it's sometimes legitimately confusing of like why, your company or something you're working on is not getting press or attention, but it's a lot less confusing when you get closer to it. And it's actually, I don't know, it's actually just very straightforward. I hope this doesn't come across as jaded at all, because I actually just appreciate how straightforward it is that investors are called investors because they invested money into these companies. Okay. They invested money. They are invested. So they have a vested interest in talking about these people that they invested in. They, you know, when someone asks them, hey, tell me a company that's been on your mind recently, they don't talk about the bootstrap company that launched on their block. They talk about the company in their portfolio that they've been spending time with. Not for any jaded reason. It's not like some Machiavellian plot. It's because literally those are the companies that they're thinking about. Those are also the companies that they have a vested interest in, you know, kind of promoting. And it can make you feel very separate from that world when you're not a part of it. And I guess if there's like a lesson to this, if you are outside of it, it is like, don't let that faze you. Like, to basically realize that everything comes out in the wash. If you're growing a great company, whether investors are talking about you or not, you're still growing a great company. You know, people talking about you in that way doesn't change it. And also, you know, what you'll notice is a pattern of everything truly does come out in the wash. If a company is getting too much attention or is on the lips of every investor, and 24 months later, that company doesn't exist because they went bankrupt, like, you'll notice all of a sudden they're not on anyone's lips anymore. Like, everything ultimately, what matters is building the great company. Whether everyone's talking about it or everyone's not talking about it is a bit irrelevant to most customers. It can have a little bit of impact, but it's just like, keep your eye on the prize and don't get frustrated that people aren't talking about you if that's, you know, the mode you're in.
I mean, for us, we actively tried to not have people talk about us for a while because we just wanted to keep building this thing and make something that we felt really proud of. We've tried a lot of stuff. Like, we have done a lot of experiments over the past, 8 years. And I think, you know, this Series A is an experiment in itself. I think one of the things that it should be like in the commandments of Lumi. We haven't written the commandments of Lumi, but one is always to look for like primary source information. Like, we want to know firsthand what it's like to do certain things. And people, many times you and I have sought advice from other people. And what I've learned, if there's like one thing that I've learned, is when it comes to entrepreneurial advice, everyone has different advice.
Yeah.
And there's no one true solution, and everyone's going to give you something different. So the only thing that we felt was the thing that we could do is just
find out for ourselves. Right. Yeah. Do you want to know if you can raise a Series A? Like, you can sit down with your metrics and your numbers and have 50 coffee meetings in a row with investors and founders and different stuff. And they can, who knows, you're going to get a bunch of different answers of like, yes, you're ready to go. No, no one will ever invest. Ultimately, you will never know until you just go out there and try, and actually ripping the Band-Aid off and just doing the thing. I don't know why as humans we have such a hard time doing that. I think it's because we get nervous and risk averse, but
there's a motto, which is the motto of the Royal Society, which is
the Royal Society of what?
It's just called the Royal Society. I guess it's like the scientific.
Like a cult?
It's like the science.
It's like British.
Yeah, science, it's like the
people.
British science.
Of course, they would just call themselves the Royal Society.
Yeah, you know, makes sense. They've been around for 357 years. I've got this pulled up on Wikipedia.
What's
here.
Their
Their motto is nullius in verba. It's a Latin phrase for take nobody's word for it.
Ooh.
So it's like a very science.
Those Brits.
No, but I think it's a very scientific principle, right? You know, it's yes, like don't yes. take anybody's word for it. Go and do the experiment, test it for yourself, and right. see for yourself.
Because often you write, I mean, in the science context, like, you know, there's endless stories of an experiment being done over and over and over countless times, and someone else does it and they notice a new thing. It leads to the next thing. They test the premise. And so, yeah, you just have to kind of go out and do it. Do you have any anecdotes, or do you want to share what it was actually like?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what were the hardest things? I was sort of leading you down a path of like, do you feel like we were well received as like two goofy box people coming to Silicon Valley? Like, I feel like for the most part, it worked out pretty okay.
We were
able to get into the
obviously,
door.
Obviously, so we bill ourselves out as like goofball slapstick comedy, but obviously the thing that gets us taken seriously is that we're building a real company with great numbers and traction. And
there's a lot of spreadsheets involved.
There's a lot of spreadsheets involved in preparing for raising, you know, a round of that size. And I think the other thing, if I may be so bold, is that we know what we're talking about. Like, I think that, and that I think in this industry and in the space and the stuff that we were saying, we are very educated about this subject. We are living it. We are breathing it. And I think that I don't want to beat up the VC industry too much in this at all. I hope I haven't. It's because I think that's something that maybe people don't appreciate that much about venture capitalists is they're like, they have to be consummate generalists, like really excellent and knowledgeable about a lot of things. And they have to be able to sit across the table from someone and ask themselves, does this person know more than me about this subject? And like the kind of more, like the double more. Like
enough.
The more that makes me feel like not only do they know more than me, not only do they know more than anyone else I've talked about in this subject, but they might know more and have like an insight that is special compared to any other human beings currently trying to start a company. And it gives this person a special edge. And there's a kind of a humbleness, I think, to it for the great VCs. And we had the pleasure of pitching a lot of tremendously intelligent people, a lot of, you know, top-tier VCs and just incredible people who I think, whether they believed in our idea as a business right off the bat, whether they believed in us right off the bat, they were very respectful because it's sort of in their nature, I think, to respect a type of knowledge that they don't yet have.
My metric that I was going for was we haven't been laughed out of the room yet.
No. Although I really do think that someone slept through, like really tried to stay conscious while I was talking to them.
About cardboard?
Well, yeah. I took a meeting with someone who just seemed to be like probably running around. Again, these people usually have very busy lives, like probably running around.
Well, you're hearing so many ideas every day. It seems exhausting.
It's got to be exhausting. I know that there's not a lot of boo-hoo-hoo for, you know, the life of VC, but it does have to be exhausting in a lot of days. So I sit down to pitch them. And clearly they had a busy day. I think they probably like got off some red-eye flight or something. And I started talking and like, I don't know. It's just like the angle of the chair and stuff as well. Like, I just really couldn't tell if they were conscious by minute five.
It was a one-on-one meeting?
I don't want to say any identifying information, but
I don't remember this one.
It was a one-on-one with, and their associate was in the room as well. But they just, yeah, there's a moment where I'm saying words and I can't tell if they are
awake. That's a bad feeling.
Awake.
Well, I don't think that was the norm, though. I think for the most part, people took this seriously.
And I don't even think this person didn't take me seriously. I just think they were really tired. But it's saying a lot because I'm loud. I'm like a energetic talker. So you got to really, really, really be tired to sleep through that.
There was an article that came out the other day that said, like last year, like 2 or 3% of venture dollars went to women.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that was a thing when you were pitching? Like, did you feel like that?
Well,
how did it feel?
I I think it's interesting. I definitely thought about it during our process. And I think as we have grown the company and kind of entering the Series A process and coming out of it, I think I started thinking about that stuff more than I ever have before. A couple different things, a couple announcements to the world. Wow. I don't know how many people are listening to this. One, I did notice instantly whether firms had female partners and general partners. And when they did, even if that wasn't who I was pitching or who might be involved in our deal, it gave me a completely different outlook on that firm. So I would encourage firms to think about that. I think that founders are paying attention. And Spark, who we ended up working with on our Series A, one of the first people we pitched there was Megan Quinn. And she's a badass.
She's awesome.
She's awesome. And it's also immediately apparent when I did that pitch that the entire firm takes her very, very seriously. It's hard to explain. I want to preface that almost with like, of course they do. I mean, it's almost silly for me to have to say this stuff out loud, but she's a general partner there. And the way that, she drove the questioning, the way that people deferred and whatnot was obvious. And what I'm saying is to compare and contrast that to other meetings I had where maybe there's a woman in the room, but the only woman in the room, maybe out of like 10 people, is someone's assistant, never speaks, never asks questions. It is noticeable.
So, and that's the norm. I mean,
the norm is there to be maybe no women involved, or I feel like it's almost a double burn when there is a woman in the room, but she's someone assistant. I don't know, guys, get dude assistants. I'm sorry. Like, change things up. Okay. But,
would that make things better?
No. It wouldn't change anything. I'm just sort of like, it just sort of, unfortunately just keeps reinforcing everything. So yeah, in any case, I was very cognizant of firms that had female partners. It was a preference that I held internally that was interesting. Other things, did I notice it in my own pitching process? This is the insidious thing, is I, for those of you who have not met me physically, I am like 5 feet tall, like 110 pounds, little brunette white girl person. They're just describing my physicality. So I've been that my whole life.
Even as a baby.
I wasn't 5 foot tall as a baby, but I don't know. From age 14 on, I've been this person. And what I'm getting at is the insidious part is I don't know what it would be like to do this process as a guy. I can never know. So any difficulty I experienced or any, comment of like, I'm just not relating to this idea, I can never know. Are they not relating to the idea? Are they not relating to me because they were never a teenage girl at one point in their lives or whatever? I don't know. So these are the unknowns are the scary. I didn't experience any derogatory, what I felt like was directly derogatory, right, or directly bad things. I do think occasionally people say that you remind them of their wives. I don't know. Sometimes there's like weird little comments that are like definitely, I don't even know if I'd refer them as off color, just kind of like completely beside the point. I mean, I think that as a female founder person, something I've said before is, you remember this, Stefan. So Stefan and I have been running companies for 8 years. I ran that first company for 4.5 years, almost 5 years, and now this one. I didn't know I was a female founder until someone told me that. Someone had to walk up to me at a Y Combinator event and go, "We have an event for you." And I go, what do you mean?
Like, for me?
Like, I just got here. Is there like a Jesse Janae welcoming committee? And they were like, no, for female founders. Like, and they actually like kind of whispered it in a weird way.
Female founders.
And anyway, from that moment on, and like, they kind of like touched my shoulder and they're like, "You're a female founder." And it's like this weird thing of like, I ran a company for 5 years and I didn't know I was a female founder.
You're just a founder.
I'm just a person, right? I'm just a CEO running a company. Running a company is hard for everyone. Doesn't matter if you're any gender or any race or whatever else. So I think that the unknowns are the thing that is difficult is what is the bias you might be up against? What are the things? How would it have gone if you weren't that thing? I'll never know. I think that the only other thing that's very noticeable, like I mentioned, is, you know, I did a pitch with a lot of people in a room at one point. Very, very dominant, like very, very male, you know,
dominated, yeah,
male dominated. And I guess you look out, here's the thing. What I can never know is if I was like a dude CEO and I look out at these 20 people-ish in the room and like 18 of them are men, do I feel some camaraderie with them? Is it easier for me to tell my story to them? Do I look out and I go like, oh, like I'm pitching people who get me. I will never know. Well, not hopefully not never, but like, I don't know that feeling. Cause what I look out at, and as I see these guys, which I'm not saying I can't relate to guys, I do, but it's, they must be so different to think like, you know, that whole backslapping, like we've all been there vibe. Like, I don't know. I can never go back and be a teenage guy at one point. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't.
Well, this was also, because of the timing, right before all of the Me Too stuff happened. I think there probably has been maybe some sort of correction in people's behaviors. I mean, it didn't feel like there was anything.
No, that's the thing. I felt like there was no untoward behavior, like none.
But I think that something that has happened in recent, like the past couple of years, is there are more funds that are getting started from the ground up with women,
yeah,
partners who are coming together and building something from scratch.
Yeah, and then I think that the other kind of global note I would say is more female founders should go out and go for that Series A, go for that next round of funding, like go continue growing the company. Don't be shy about it, because the more, like there has to be a push into the market. We all have to keep trying. Again, it sounds so obvious, but unfortunately, you know, the numbers won't change if we don't do that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's YC always says this, but they're like,
yeah,
basically they're accepting women into the YC program at a rate that is like equal or above a number that are applying or something like that. But it's still low, you know?
Right. So, yeah, it's a classic, like it's a pipeline problem,
right?
And that's actually used to describe a lot of different fucked up things.
Discrimination.
Yeah. Like it's about, we just can't find these people. So I'm certainly not accusing my company of that at all, but I just think that it's too simplistic of an explanation. So let's keep working on it.
Let's dive into some more questions, because there were a couple that came in.
What do we got?
Here's one from Josh. Josh is on our team. Are there any tips or tricks either of you have for maximizing hours of productivity? This is kind of related to that other one, but it's like on a more micro scale.
Interesting. Well, Josh, I think that productivity is something that we are all always striving for, like measuring ourselves by how much got actually done in a day or a week or a month or a year, as opposed to how busy we were, right? Like we all know what it's like to be busy, but how much did we get done? So I think that one productivity hack that is maybe underrated, there's a lot of like tips and tricks for getting through the day and stuff like that. But a productivity hack that I think is just underrated is really good metrics, like really good goals around what you do want done that day, that week, that month, and how you can quantify it in numbers. So, you know, like what is the challenge? What is the thing they're having trouble with productivity wise? Like, oh, I'm trying to make sure that everyone in my inbox gets a quick response. It's like, okay, cool. Well, what's quick mean? You can use tons of tools to actually measure your response time. Is quick an hour? Is quick 5 hours? What are you at right now? What's your baseline? What's your baseline right now? Is your baseline, like if you want to be quicker, how do you know what quicker is if you haven't measured yourself now? And I just think a lot of humans think like in these vagaries, like that thing I just mentioned. I will hear people all the time say like, I want to be better at this. I want to be quicker at this, etc. And then when I ask them, what's your baseline? What's the thing you're measuring against? They have no idea. So imagine how insane it is to say, I want to be quicker and not know how quick you are now. It's almost impossible. So I think measurement and setting good metrics is like a really good way of unlocking your own productivity.
Yeah, I mean, being productive is like...
What does it even mean, Josh? Right. It's like a philosophical...
What are you trying to do?
Because, yeah, if you're trying to be a productive like monk, you know, maybe it's like how many hours of meditation per day you got through and how many connections to the ethereal network of you made that day.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this earlier, but there's literally a million to-do apps, and I don't think any specific like prescribed method is good for anyone. The thing that I've tried to do is like, if I'm going to go like really nitty gritty on something, the thing that I've done lately that has been really nice for me, I used to keep like a big to-do list of all these things that I needed to do. And some of them were sort of aspirational, like I want to do, you know, I have this big idea that I want to explore. And I would have these things that are on my to-do list like permanently. And it was just very frustrating because you never can check them out. And so you really have to like make things as granular as possible to like, I can achieve this.
Yep.
So what I've been doing...
Chunk it out.
Yeah, what I've been doing lately is just in the morning, I start a new document from scratch and I'm like, what am I going to do today?
I also, other things, okay, so other things about productivity I feel I've gotten to at this point is really avoiding things that break up my flow. So something that happens more and more when you're growing a company is people hit you up and they want to just talk. They're like, comes in a million forms. Let's catch up. Maybe with someone you already know. I want to have coffee and pick your brain. Maybe with someone you've never met. Everything in between. I mean, it just gets more and more. People want to sell you things, whatever else. And you could have your whole day booked solid with stuff like that. And we all know that's not the makings of like getting your job done. But it's very hard to do none of it, right? It's very hard to like tell everyone no and be that kind of curmudgeon-y human being. So you got to find mechanisms for doing it. So one is making a rule for yourself that you only do a certain type of meeting before or after business hours. So actually... just since we're talking about fundraising and VCs and stuff, more recently, if there's a VC who is not a current investor of Lumi, who I maybe know, like I like these people, they're great people, they're smart people, I love catching up with them, but maybe they're not involved in Lumi yet, I will do everything I can to maybe meet with them before 9 or after 6. So breakfast before 9 or drinks or something after 6 or a weekend call, because that's the appropriate time in the day for me to do that. I don't need to take an hour away from my team at Lumi and the things that I'm trying to build to catch up with someone, even if I really, really want to. So it's not about not wanting to. So I think that kind of time bucketing as well of like, I only do catch-ups with friends or coffees or like exploratory things with VCs, etc., outside of, you know, before 9 or after 6, if I can't fit that in. And if that means it needs to wait a couple weeks, then that's fine, because I need to prioritize my team.
Good stuff. Another question that came in from Ethan Bodner was, I don't know if I pronounced that right, but any additional thoughts that you'd add to this post based on what you've seen in the last year? And he's referring to something that I wrote back in 2016, which was titled Vertical Commerce and How the Next Generation of Retail Will Be Built. And I linked to that in our announcement the other day because there was a phrase that I used in there. I don't remember it off the top of my head, but something along the lines of the new generation of online companies are interested in thinking about the physical products they sell as bits rather than atoms. Like instead of thinking of your inventory or your packaging or your freight as like these physical things, people want to think of them as digital things that they can scale up or shrink down or move around geographically. So we sort of reference that because that's a big area of investment for us right now is how do we continue to build the software that helps people kind of abstract away some of these problems into software.
So would you change anything about your piece?
I got to tell you, I reread it like a bunch of times and I was like this is solid.
Good.
This is good stuff. I don't think I would change anything, but I would add some things.
Okay.
That just to give people context, and we'll put a link in the show notes, like the four big topics that I talked about were there were sort of four predictions that I had for the future. One was online sales will continue to grow. And that was just based on like data. If you look at the data, the trend line is still there. Two, software will continue to reduce barriers. There's been some great new software, like I might mention some other new software that has come out since then. Three, modern logistics will help them scale. That's mm-hmm. what we've been working on. Mm-hmm. Four is old school strategies will come back. Those were the titles. Mm-hmm. And that one meant
people experimenting with physical retail.
Retail consolidation, like mm-hmm. bringing, like, which is basically what Jet.com has been doing with mm-hmm. buying bonobos and stuff like that. So I think that in these different themes, I think maybe I would add a couple things. Like, you know, I wrote this before some of the big acquisitions like bonobos. Like mm-hmm. I would point to that example as mm-hmm. like a trend that occurred. I would say that in the category of software that helps businesses, we have a lot more things like chat interfaces mm-hmm. and like customer service platforms that are getting a little bit smarter and using AI and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. that's a really interesting thing. If I were to add like two bigger forces that are at play, I would say one of them is like Amazon has really continued its dominant streak. Like they've really continued to grow. And it's a topic we talk a lot about on the podcast. Like, what is Amazon not good at? What are the areas that, you know, this new generation of brands can take advantage of? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I have a lot of respect for Amazon as a mm-hmm. company. They're just like quite an amazing company. But what do you do to like prevent your house from getting blown down by the big bad wolf?
Yeah. Because I mean, you know, we see a lot of, you know, VCB style companies, direct to consumer brands launch with like a strong product offering, and you can watch the private label version come on Amazon, you know, a month later, 2 months later, whatever, a little bit later. And I'm sure that's having, you know, an effect on their bottom line and on the overall industry and on the overall, like it affects everything that comes after. Like it might affect whether someone else is ready to jump in and start their own brand because they're fearful of that happening and whatnot. So, yeah.
What are your thoughts about that? Like if you're someone starting a business from scratch today, a direct-to-consumer company, what's your Amazon strategy? What are you doing to try and counter them copying you or counter them eating your lunch somehow or forcing you to sell through their platform or whatever it is?
Well, I think that a lot of the direct-to-consumer brands doing a phenomenal job have like continued and like sustained utility and interest from their consumers. So I think that, of course, physical goods are always at risk of being commoditized, meaning like it's whether it's leggings or candy or like a piece of luggage, customers want the best price. And if it seems like they can get a very, very similar thing from Amazon, there's just an inherent risk there. At the same time, customers are really interesting people. Like we talk, like customers, we talk about them as though it's like this amorphous mass of people. Like, I don't know, if you're going to school or you're walking on the street, you're looking at customers. Like, FYI, wake up and smell the customers. They're everywhere. They're one of us. Like, it's like this thing of like, wake up and realize that customers are human beings and you know them. And so even though the rational thing to do, if you were to like plug yourself into like some customer matrix, would be to always select the like lowest price, most similar thing to what you want. The reality is that customers are human beings. And what are human beings? Emotional. We like stories. We like other human beings. We like ethical stuff. We have all these other human elements to us. And I think that a lot of the great brands are they're reaching us on a human level.
Right.
And they're reaching us on a human level that like a price compare button doesn't really like change. You know, I'm a fan of a bunch of different brands. I could never name them all, but off the top of my head, I wear a lot of Outdoor Voices stuff.
I was going to mention them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, obviously they're building an incredibly powerful brand. For those that don't know, it's athletic apparel, men and women, just really beautiful design, really body positive, you know, branding and incredible photography, et cetera, and much, much more. You can go check them out, Outdoor Voices. But they, like, I don't care if Jeff Bezos wants to, like, make, like, what look like, you know, color-blocked leggings and throw them up on Amazon. I'm not buying them, Jeff.
But I think it's fascinating because, you know, one of the things that is the most powerful thing that you can build today, and I think that, weirdly enough, the world of, like, cryptocurrency kind of, like, plays into this, mm-hmm. is, like, a network, a sort of decentralized network of people who care about a certain thing,
yeah,
who are, like,
kind of, like,
invested
freak out
into that thing.
And yeah. They kind of go, like, no!
Well, and I think, and Glossier is another brand mm-hmm. that has done an incredible job with this, where it's, like, if you can have a community at the root of your company, it's almost more powerful than the products that you sell.
Right.
It's, like, they will, and that's what happened with Outdoor Voices. Like, their fans went nuts on this other company.
Right. And so, I mean, both of those brands are prime examples. And it's like Glossier has this incredible, like, basically publication and online community. In addition, both of them have an incredible online community. In addition, but it's almost not fair to say in addition to their products, because in reality, what you're hitting upon is that they are a community. And then that community, like, has a hunger for these products, and that's what drives more revenue back into that organization so they can keep growing and launching new things.
It's hard to build a community, though. It takes a long time.
Yeah. But the core thing is, it's not instantly replicatable. It is not. People are fickle. People have allegiances. You can't just throw up a pair of leggings on a website and call it a day. So I think those are things that create this really fertile ground, even for a young upstart it creates a fertile territory for a young upstart, even in a world of Amazon.
Yeah. That's good stuff. Let's see, what else we got? Well, we're almost running out of time.
Oh,
so I want to end, because this is kind of a big one.
Oh.
I want to end on this theme,
okay,
which was maybe a little more philosophical.
Uh-oh.
I don't know. Recommendations. How was your trip to Tokyo? Best thing you ate, any experiences there that are just unique to Japan.
Wow.
Give some context for the people.
Okay, so Stefan and I, in addition to being business co-founders, are also best friends. Yeah.
Wow. You said it.
I said it out loud. It's real. It's official. People should know that. And I think people say that, like, people are like, yeah, I really like my co-founder. And they, like, give him, like, a tug on the shoulder or something. No, guys, we actually really like each other and we're friends. And so we go on vacation sometimes together. We went to Japan.
It was a rare, like, 2 week long vacation.
Stefan had to literally book it against my will. He booked this trip against my will, like, against my very nature, every fiber of my being, because he was like, we just came off the fundraiser and everything. He's like, we need a break. I didn't argue with that. But then he said, let's go to Japan. And I was in, and he said, like, for like 2 weeks. And I was like, I can't even fathom leaving for 2 weeks.
We have not taken a break for more than a week, I think, in the past 8 years.
In the past 8 years, there's definitely never been a time we go away for 2 weeks. We were still, like, checking in and stuff. But he booked this trip. We went to Japan.
Neither of us had been before.
We've never been before. Went to Tokyo, went to Kyoto, went to an art island called Naoshima. Okay, so what's my favorite stuff? Well, I would say favorite meal was...
I don't know where you're going with this.
There's an even smaller art island called Toshima.
Yeah.
We went to Toshima.
Now I know what you're going to say, but that's really fascinating to me.
And it's a tiny island with like less than 1,000 people on it.
Yeah.
And so the fancy restaurant in town is this place, this like little building, and we walked up and it said, all the signs said open, like it was very confusing because all the signs said open and everything, but then all the doors were shut and everything was dark, and we started knocking and this lady came out and she barely spoke English and she was like, and we were like, dinner, like we were trying to communicate that we wanted to eat there, and she was like, come back in an hour. She didn't even say that in English. We used a clock as a whole thing. But anyway, she basically said, come back in an hour. We were very confused. So we walked back to our Airbnb. There's one Airbnb on the island, just to put everything in perspective for you guys. We walked back to our Airbnb. We came back in an hour. And this restaurant is this woman's home. We sat in her living room and she served us like a 10-course meal that she cooked entirely by herself from scratch, served to us from her own hands. And it was like this incredible experience. And we sat on little floor mats and stuff in her living room and ate this meal. It was like this beautiful, incredible meal. So that would, I would say, is like favorite.
That was very special.
Very yeah. special.
And it was like the fanciest place, but it was still probably like $30.
Yeah, it was like $30 or something for like this woman to like cook us a
playing some like
dinner.
Nice jazzy music and like yes. It was amazing.
It was amazing yeah. and the food.
And we were the
was
only
really
people
good.
There.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like we thought it was a restaurant, and I mean, I guess why am I? I'm not. I guess it is a restaurant. She served us food, but it was like this. We were in her living room, so it was incredible. So I would say that was my favorite meal. We did a lot of incredible things. Do you have a favorite activity maybe you want to share?
I think the thing that I'm going to remember, there was a lot of good stuff, but yeah. the thing that I'm always going to remember is when we, first of all, staying in Kyoto in the ryokan was amazing. Ryokan is like a traditional bed and breakfast inn type mm-hmm. of thing. And they're just like little houses all over Japan that you can stay at.
Yeah, but you're staying in the old-fashioned environment. Like you're in a tatami mat room, sleeping on a futon on the ground. You're wearing little robes and whatnot. I'm sure there's...
Kimono.
Kimono. Like I already apologize.
The slippers and everything.
I hope I am already not coming across as culturally insensitive. I promise I was very respectful.
It was great.
It was great.
It was amazing. Yes. So that was great. But the first day that we were in Kyoto, we went to this house. It's called the Murinen mm-hmm. House. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's one of those things where it's like hard to put it into perspective when it's the first thing that you do. But in retrospect, it was still one of my favorite things in the whole trip.
Tell us more.
So Kyoto is sort of a more old school part of Japan. It's the second biggest city, but it's very traditional. There's a lot of Shinto shrines. It's very beautiful. But this house is like designed in a very traditional Japanese style, was commissioned by a rich Japanese businessman at the end of the 19th century, and has a beautiful garden. It's not huge or anything. It's like
it's not like a palace or something. It's just like a normal
decent-sized
house.
But very well designed and part of this very beautiful garden. And one of the things that we did, which was like next level, that I want to do again somehow, but it's the pairing is so perfect, was Jesse, you got like AirPods.
I had Apple AirPods
for Christmas or something.
For Christmas,
your mom gave you AirPods.
Yes.
And then we had pulled up this essay
called "In Praise of Shadows"
by Tanizaki. It's an essay that anyone who's a designer or creative person should listen to or read.
Everyone should just go listen to it. It's like a two and a half hour or one and a half. It's about 90 minutes on Audible if you want to go listen. And it's like this incredible essay all about like the Japanese sensibility of like aesthetics and...
Compared to Western. Yeah.
So here we are, these Western people walking around this beautiful home and garden.
It was written in like 1930. So it was like close to when
this house was built. Constructed.
It was just very related. I think it was weird because I don't think we knew that going in.
I don't think we explained the AirPods thing. The reason why we're talking about the AirPods is that AirPods enable a fun thing, which is like pair listening. So I gave Stefan an AirPod and I had an AirPod and we were both able to listen to the same thing at the same time.
But we could also kind of like walk.
We could hear each other talk.
15 feet or like 20 feet.
Before we get like scratchy. So we were like having this very... kind of transcendent experience where we're both walking around this house in this garden.
It's very peaceful,
very
quiet.
Peaceful, that was constructed near the 1930s, listening to a book written in the 1930s about Japanese aesthetics.
And
we're
literally looking at, it's all about like how you would build a house and where you would put your toilet and like what kind of light bulbs you would use. And like, we're literally looking at all this stuff while listening to it.
Yeah, I think it was just like the whole pairing was like this perfect kind of human experience. So.
And that's you don't have to go to Japan and like to listen to this.
No,
you
should just listen. Yeah, we're not trying to make you feel like you're getting like a subpar experience if you're not walking around a Japanese house listening to this. But it's a good essay no matter what.
I really like the contrast of everything there. You know, like Tokyo is so intense. There's so much going on. It's like big city, lots of stuff. Kyoto is so much more relaxed and peaceful and beautiful in a different way. Going to the islands was like kind of remote, kind of going into like more of a countryside type of experience. So I just really liked going to all those different places, and pretty much everything was delicious. Like, I think that my favorite meals were always the ones where we were so hungry after like a day of walking around the shrines.
We just needed like a million dumplings.
Yeah. And we would just like find a great spot. Like we had tons of great recommendations for people and we went to some of those places. But for me, the memorable places were the places that weren't on the list, the places that like just hit the spot. Like that, the one that you mentioned was like recommended by this like Japanese guy who hosted us in his house. So go to Japan and listen to Tanizaki's In Praise of Shadows. All right. I think we have to do this again because we're going to get more questions.
I know. And you guys should ask really good questions. Here's what you don't understand is I will answer any question.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I guess like I'll just reserve like some human judgment.
But you might veto some.
I might veto something. But I generally think that I feel like people are very polite in the questions they ask. They're like, "How was this?" You can ask like a hard-hitting question. We won't be offended. I think that those are the interesting ones, and I really like a good meaty question, you know. And I think that we try to be as open as we can. So feel free to send us some hard balls or some questions that you know you're not sure if we can even answer publicly. Like we'll give stuff a shot, you know.
Can you promise me to come back before 2019?
I promise.
All right.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.